I said, the topic of this lecture is, how can conflicts be resolved without war? And if one raises this question, I think one has to add another sentence, namely that very definitely conflicts cannot be resolved by war in this century anymore. So that we are not even free to say it would be nice if we could find ways to solve or resolve conflicts without war, but we have to say unless we find such ways, not only conflicts will not be resolved, but even according an optimistic prognosis, Western civilization will have gone and all the values which we cherish and of which we say we are willing to fight, or at least some people say. Now, if I speak about the question of how conflicts can be resolved without war, I want to speak about two sets of different approaches. One is an approach which one could call primarily a political realistic one, namely, and I shall talk about this somewhat more in detail in a minute, that in order to solve conflicts without war, A, one has to know the facts, and B, one has to interpret the facts correctly. The second set of the second approach is one which you might call a human, philosophical, spiritual, religious, whatever, psychological, I almost forgot my own profession, one, and for good reasons, which I shall deal with in the second part of this lecture. Now, let me first state one fact, that indeed one has to acknowledge how correct Freud was in his theory of repression, or what a very great psychiatrist, Harry Stack Sullivan, used to call selective inattention. When one considers the amount of distortion of simple facts which goes on today with regard to the political situation. Let me give you two examples. One is a personal experience, which I had about a year ago in discussing the Berlin question with one of the most distinguished writers in foreign policy in the United States, and with a few other people who are very active in politics and, in fact, quite on quite responsible position. I was stating the case that I believe we have badly embarrassed Mr. Khrushchev by promising, at that time once, now it is twice, or by indicating, it wasn't a promise, by indicating that we are willing to make some face-saving gesture in the Berlin question, that this was discussed at the 59 Foreign Ministers Conference, where we discussed the problem of symbolic troop reduction in Berlin, in West Berlin, and cessation of anti-communist radio broadcasts from Berlin, West Berlin, directed against the Eastern Zone and the Communist Empire. We had, of course, never made a formal arrangement. This was discussed. Then Mr. Khrushchev came to Washington. There was a Camp David spirit. There was an official communique which said we will go on with this Berlin question. It was pretty clear that some kind of a very informal gentleman's pre-agreement or pre-arrangement had been made. Then came the famous Dylan speech, which torpedoed the whole spirit of Camp David. And that all in spite of the fact that the Russians had withdrawn their time limit. We always said we don't negotiate under pressure. We won't make concessions of any kind if we are threatened. So Khrushchev took back the time limit, and then we treated him like some parents treat a naughty child. They say, as long as you shout and yell, I won't give to you what you want. And then when the child stops shouting, you don't do it either. We did that twice. We did it last September again. There were apparently serious negotiations with the Russians about some solution. Khrushchev took back the deadline again, which he had set for the end of last year. And then suddenly, after conversations which seemed to be quite successful of some solution, we accepted the German-French position, no concessions whatsoever, we are where we were before. Well, the Berlin question is important enough, so I took a few minutes to describe it more fully, but I wanted to come back, really. The main point of this remark is to show what happens. This newspaper man said to me, "Mr. Fromm, you are dreaming. There was never a 59 ministers foreign ministers conference. There was never a discussion of troop reduction and so on." And I said, "Well, you probably wrote about it 2 years ago." But he insisted this never took place. And among the other five people, while nobody had quite the self-confidence of denying this, nobody remembered at all. Well, I thought, was I crazy? I didn't think I was, because I remembered the events well enough, so I went the next morning to the Washington Post just to make sure that I'm sane, and got out from their files the issue, the post of that, and of course there it was. Now, this is some extraordinary fact, that people who are professionally in this, after it was then 2 years, can simply forget one of the most important facts in this whole business of our negotiation with the Soviets on Berlin. Then I was in New York, I got the Russian disarmament treaty draft from Sein, and to my great amazement, I see in the Russian draft that it precisely suggests international inspection of all production of carriers, missiles, planes, fissional material, conventional weapons, the workshops, even the machine tools needed for it and so on, and that our position that the Russians will not admit international inspection of production is simply not so. Now, one can make a point and can say, and this point has I discussed with a physicist recently, one can say, all right, the Russians are willing to permit inspection of all their factories, of all means of production, but who guarantees to us that they might not in the meantime build new factories, new centers of production, of which we do not know and which are secret? Well, of course, if one starts on this logic, there's really hardly any possibility to come to an agreement, because how can one have such a foolproof inspection that the possibility of secret new factories is completely excluded? But I'm not even arguing on this point. Maybe one could find a way. Maybe the Sohn plan of choosing small sectors of the country could be discussed also with regard to the possibility of having new factories of which we know nothing. What I'm mentioning here is the fact that in the reports on American press, I have not seen a single report which mentions the fact that the Russians propose inspection of production. In fact, it was a very funny situation. I wrote a letter to the Times, which was published in the last Sunday edition, stating this error, and their letter department asked me, could I send them the draft, because they didn't have it there. So I did. But it is a kind of paradoxical situation that I have to send certain news items to the New York Times. Well, now, what I meant to say was that in the first place, there is a great deal of plain distortion of facts. And the word inattentive selection is a very selective inattention is a very good word, because nobody is lying. All these statements are made in good faith. But what happens is precisely the same that what you see, let us say, in one of these marriage conflicts which marriage counselors take care of. You hear the husband and the wife give a report of terrible scenes and difficulties and fights they have. Both are telling the truth as they see it. And yet, by the process of selective inattention, they select one set of facts, the other one selects another set of facts. And actually, when you listen to both, you cannot even believe that they are talking about the same situation. Both have the same degree of righteous indignation. Both cannot understand how the other one could possibly look at these facts the way he does. And yet the mechanism is very simple. If you select certain facts on this side and certain facts on this side, you arrive at a picture which is so convincing because you are not really lying, you are only distorting in a particular way of omitting certain things. Now, the more important question is, of course, well, I wouldn't even say the more important question, but the other important question, as far as the facts are concerned, is not the knowledge of the facts, but is the interpretation of the facts. And here we deal really with very difficult problems. How are we to interpret the Soviet Union? The current opinion is that the Soviet Union is a communist revolutionary regime, essentially in the spirit of Marx and Lenin and Trotsky, and this regime has a crusading messianic spirit to spread communism over the world. And that while, because they are also afraid of war, they have given up the idea of using force for this crusading spirit, or for this crusading enterprise, they certainly wait for the moment whereby subversion or other means they can eventually revolutionize and communize the Western world. In this view, Marx, Lenin, and Stalin, and Khrushchev are all the same. They all represent the same revolutionary idea. And if one asks a person who has that idea, but on what do you base this conviction? He will say, quite sincerely, but the Russians say so themselves. What could be more convincing? Now, let me give you an example of, in order to get to the point I have in mind here, of our own Western world. And I hope you will feel I do not, what I'm saying here, say with any disrespect for a particular religious belief, but I think you will also recognize what I'm talking about is a fact. The Christian Church, certainly the Catholic Church and many Protestant churches, believe in the second coming of Christ. They do not only believe it, but they ardently wish it, according to the theory. The second coming of Christ means the complete destruction of all worldly organization as it existed in history so far, and a revolution in comparison with which Lenin's world revolution would be really a harmless kindergarten play. Now, somebody has read all the theology books, all the decisions of the various church assemblies and so on. Let us say somebody on Mars or even further distant who has read all these books and plans a visit to Earth would certainly be convinced that the most dangerous people to existing governments are the Pope, the Cardinals, all true good Catholics, and most of the Protestants, because they are sitting there and waiting for the downfall of all worldly government. If he comes here, he will go through some very puzzling moments, because he will discover that that isn't so. That the churches have by no means a threat for the last 2,000 years to existing governments, with a few exceptions, and these were either the heretic sects or the post-Reformation sects. The Quakers sometimes have been a threat to the government, but not at all because of even of the thesis of the second coming of Christ, but simply because they were Christians, and because they made a difference between what is Caesar's and what is God's, and didn't try to say that quite naturally God and Caesar usually agree. Now, if we ask then, does anyone lie here? The answer is no. Certainly, most people, from the Pope downwards, will sincerely believe in this. Just as most husbands believe that they love their wives, most parents believe that they love their children, and yet most people believe that they believe in God, everybody is sincere, except that there is that peculiar gray area of the human mind, in which I believe in something, in some idea, in which I use some words, and yet this idea has no potency. This idea remains pallid. Well, I give you this example from our culture to lead to the point that what happens in Russia is pretty much the same thing. Russia was indeed a revolutionary system from 1917 to, let us say, 1922. Lenin, and this is clear from all historical facts, would never have even started the revolution and attempted to seize power had he not been convinced that the revolution would break out in Germany at least, and hence that there was a basis for the existence of a communist or socialist Russia, which were agricultural Russia would be combined with an industrial Germany, and there would have been a basis at least for their idea in terms of their own Marxist concept. Now, Lenin was completely mistaken about that, just as Marx was completely mistaken in the middle of the 19th century. They believed the revolution was around the corner, and it wasn't at all. They believed that capitalism was at the end of its development, and they didn't see that capitalism had still resources and possibilities of change, which would make it a very viable and strong system. You might say a good fate saved Lenin from facing full the dilemma, because he died. And then comes Stalin, and Stalin does something which was exceedingly clever, namely, he used the charismatic names of Marx and Lenin, he used the ideology or the ideas of Marx to build up a system which in every respect, or let us say in almost every respect, was a contradiction of Marxism, and in some respects a contradiction even of what Lenin wanted, although Lenin himself distorted Marx and Marxism a great deal as a great Marxist revolutionary like Rosa Luxemburg saw clearly already when the Russian Revolution broke out. What Stalin did was to build in the name of socialism, of Marx, of Lenin, a state capitalism based on the capitalistic principle that all creative effort is essentially based on the profit incentive. No capitalist in the Western world speaks as bluntly about that as the Russians do. You may have read in the last few days a Russian discussion in which a leading economist says that all these ideas about leveling of wages among workers are against the communist principle, that you have to have precisely the incentive for the amount of effort and skill which every worker uses. Now, this is not anything new. Stalin said that many years ago, but they find it necessary, apparently even now, to still stress that principle, which usually is a capitalist principle. In fact, if you show these quotes to anyone without saying that they come from Russia, then he would say, well, that must be the spokesman of the American Association of Manufacturers, but he shouldn't really be quite that blunt. Because in this day and age, one speaks more of human happiness than of the profit incentive. In the West, the Russians are not so sensitive about it. But what I mean to say is that the Soviet system now is actually a system which is mixed of three elements. One is a completely monopolized managerial economy in which monopolization has reached degrees which go far beyond that development which we find in the so-called capitalist countries. It's a super monopoly, the super cartel, as one called it, as German economists called it. And this aspect is a development which in Western capitalism has begun in the 20th century, which is not yet completed, and yet if you see the various mergers and the within Western industry, you can see that is the way we are proceeding. There is incidentally another element which has often been discussed by Bell and by others, that in the Western world, the property in the means of production has ceased to be an important question. The manager separated from the owners, the property is held by many individuals, and in fact the management in itself does in general not own the enterprise anymore. You have in Italy, for instance, or in less developed industrial countries, still some cases in which big enterprises are owned by a person who manages it. But the general development is not in this direction. And as far as the bureaucratic, hierarchical, managerial structure of society is concerned, the Russians are just a few steps ahead of ourselves. Whether that is in itself desirable or not is another question. The principle is that of maximum consumption, maximum production. They, like we, believe in a pre-established harmony in which that which is good for production is also good for men. And with us, the psychologists have gladly accepted the task of making men believe that there is really no and couldn't be any contradiction between the interest of production and the interest of man. Now that is precisely the opposite of Marxism and of the idea of socialism, but this is the idea which the Russians represent even more brazenly than we do, but maybe that is because they don't have so many psychologists and a science of so-called human relations. The second element in the Russian system is a welfare state, as we see it in the Western countries developing, except that the Russian welfare state is by far not as complete as what the British have done and what the Scandinavian countries have done. The third element is a cultural level, an aim for men, which is, as you can see from the latest, from the news program of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, centered around the concept duty, patriotism, family, and work. Now, some of you will remember General Pétain in his Vichy time. These were his slogans, and indeed, the new Soviet man, as he is outlined in the latest program, is much more similar to the ideas of Pétain or Salazar, and in no way, in the remotest sense, can be connected with the ideas of Marx or Engels about men. Now, these are the three elements. The welfare state, the state monopolistic capitalism, or whatever word you use, the reactionary concepts for men. Frankly, the Russians are in the Victorian age and in the ugliest part of the Victorian age, really, and eventually the welfare state. Now, all this is bound together by an ideology which pretends to be to represent the ideas of Marx and to some extent of Lenin. And all I'm saying is that if you really study this ideology, you see the flaws. You see that large parts of Marx have simply been chopped off because they don't fit into this conservative, reactionary, and anti-humanist regime. Other parts have been distorted, and actually, I'm sure the real concept which a man like Khrushchev has of socialism, what he means by socialism, and he says so quite frankly, is socialism is a system in which industry is nationalized, in which there is planning, and in which managers direct the workers. And if you remember what Mr. Khrushchev said at when he was in this country some years ago, all he was talking about was to show the superiority of the Russian system over ours by showing we can produce better. Our system is more efficient, it's more conducive to maximum production, and actually, I am pretty sure that if we ask what Mr. Khrushchev really feels, why what he calls communism will conquer the world, will rule into the, in the world, is that he feels something as, let us say, the marriage of 100,000 men planned in Detroit would feel looking at a little plant where they produce the same product in a plant of 300 men. That is old-fashioned, it's inefficient, it is of the past, the future belongs to the big plan, to the big organization, to the big hierarchy. It belongs, to use a word, to the corporation, to the big corporation, not anymore to the small entrepreneur, which was essentially the case in the 19th century capitalism. Now we ask, but why does Khrushchev talk about why does he talk about revolution, but he doesn't talk about revolution, really. I wish you would read the latest program of the Communist Party. You will really be surprised about the language even, about the ideology. But still, why does he speak about his hope that our grandchildren will live under communism? Why does he quote Marx? Why does he quote Lenin? Well, precisely for the same reason. He needs an ideology. Everybody needs the feeling that he is doing something which is good, which is virtuous, which will lead to a better future. He needs something for the population to believe in. But in fact, I'm convinced from what I read about Russia that they are in the same difficulty we are in, namely that their communist ideology has very little traction, that the young generation doesn't believe in it. Take, for instance, one little detail, that they had to introduce capital punishment for rape, which is not precisely the crime of old men, because apparently their young generation is getting more and more out of hand, and their real way of keeping the young generation in line is, I think, the same we do: more consumer goods, more satisfactions, more consumption satisfactions. And for the rest, we believe in God, and they believe in communism, and yet what we really believe is in a new Jaguar, and what they believe is in the hope of having a new Jaguar for their children, and at the moment, the hope of a little car. As I see it, these are the facts. I don't mean to be facetious. I mean to present the facts as I see them, and I'm very glad that we have the occasion today to discuss what I am saying, and that we can argue it out, and that we can discuss what the objections are to my view of seeing these things. Now, I want to say one more word about the whole problem of interpretation of history. And here we have a real difficulty in the English-speaking countries as against the European countries, with the exception of Great Britain. I was discussing some time ago with one of the most intelligent liberal leaders of the country the question of Germany. And I said, yes, it's perfectly true. Germany at the moment, West Germany, does not have a big army, does not yet have directly atomic bombs, weapons. It is not yet... It says it wants peace and all that, but don't you see that since about 1895, there are forces in Germany which tend to expansion, because Germany has a tremendous, since the end of the last century, industrial potential, which in itself, in order to be saturated, needs economic expansion. It has a Junker class with a very excellent military tradition. The German generals were not as bright as it would look. If you read the book on guns in August, on the first 3 months of the First World War, you will see that they were rather stupid, but the French generals were still more stupid. And that is usually what happens, so one wins. But nevertheless, while they were not so bright, they had devotion, discipline, and a military tradition which was quite effective. And the combination of these factors made for German expansionism, which for the first time tried to realize its aims in the First World War, for the second time in the Second World War, and I'm convinced that in new forms, or more streamlined forms, the aim is still the same in West Germany. This time it's united New Europe with, as they say, with an integrated Germany, which is a euphemistic way of saying under the domination of Germany, but the French are permitted to go on talking French. And not only that, they are permitted to concentrate on agriculture, while Germany will concentrate on industrial products. And this will be indeed new. There is a possibility of a new empire of 300 million people, which may be economically, militarily stronger than the United States on the one side or the Soviet bloc on the other side. Now, I was saying, when I was trying to explain this to the man with whom I was talking, he said to me, "But Mr. Fromm, this is mystical. You talk about forces which operate behind the surface. There is no such thing. All that I see is Germany has only 12 divisions. Chancellor Adenauer says we want peace. Chancellor Adenauer says we don't want to reconquer or regain our lost territories by war." And all this talk about forces is sheer mysticism. Well, even if it were, it wouldn't be mysticism, but the word mysticism is used in peculiar ways, even among educated people these days. But that's not the point. The whole point is that an analysis of the history, an analysis of the given situation of a country, in my own way of looking at things, and in this respect, I believe that Hegel and Marx and some earlier thinkers have contributed greatly to our understanding of the social process, just as Freud has contributed to an understanding of the individual process, that one cannot understand where a country, where a political system is moving to, unless one understands the forces which operate and which are not visible directly, but which can be inferred from many things. This is actually the science of politics, as against the behavioristic, purely descriptive political so-called science. It is, after all, always the task of science to penetrate through the surface, to penetrate through what the senses and what common sense offer us, and to arrive at the essence, at the core, at the forces behind these phenomena, which in themselves have certain results, so that one can predict events to a certain extent. And by predict, I don't mean one can say, this will necessarily happen. That would be determinism of an old-fashioned kind. But that one can predict in the sense of saying, there are two or three alternatives, and ascertainable alternatives. And one of them will necessarily happen, and we can study what the conditions are, why alternative number one or two or three will happen, and hence also what could be done to increase the possibility for any one of these alternatives to happen. This is different from the old-fashioned determinism, in which there is really no concept of freedom, but it's also very different from the concept which is so popular in the United States of never thinking in terms of forces, but always thinking in terms of what happens now. In other words, I'm saying, from the purely realistic political standpoint, what is necessary are two things. A, to see the facts clearly, not to distort them, and B, to interpret the facts in a dynamic sense and not in a descriptive sense. Now I come to an entirely different set of premises, namely to the fact of certain moral, human, psychological consideration in all this. We are accustomed to the picture of certain alternatives which are fixed. Now you see that in private life. People get into great trouble because they cannot get out of the cliché of certain clichés of certain alternatives. Either divorce or the wife will do whatever the husband says. Well, that's exaggerated. People are more sophisticated these days to put it that way, but that's often what the core of the matter is, or vice versa. The man does whatever she wants. or any number of alternatives which seem to be fixed, from which there is no way out, and both alternatives are actually impossible. Now, with regard to our conflict with the Soviet Union, the cliché alternative is, as some people put it, either red or dead, so we have to choose, and that some people prefer being dead than red, and allegedly some people prefer to be red than dead, but there are all sorts of mixtures. For instance, Mr. Khan, in his last book, said that as a national policy, it would be impossible to say that it is better to be dead than red, because no political leader can really decree the death of his population. It's really more of an individual problem. Of course, I don't want to go into that in detail, it would take too much time. But let me tell you a story. This is a North American Indian legend dealing with how the Grand Canyon was created. Some of you may know it. Story is that a young man in a small tribe had the criminal thought of wanting to marry a girl from another tribe. That was as criminal then as some other things are supposed to be criminal. Now, in fact, we are not much better, because our intermarriage procedures are still pretty much on the tribal level. But never mind. So he had this very criminal and crazy idea. So he drove around, visited other villages, other tribes, and in one he saw a girl. They looked at each other and they fell in love with each other. And he said, "All right, I'll come back," he said that to her and to the elders, "and I'll take her home and marry her." Well, the elders, of course, in this village, who were in this tribe, were equally incensed, so they decided to kill him, which is perfectly logical from their standpoint. The girl sent out messengers to warn the boy not to return, but of course he didn't listen to these warnings. But he did something which was much more clever than most people are. He said, "Now, tell me only one thing, precisely at what moment are they going to kill me?" Because they were going to give a big feast, and in all this goings on, he was to be killed at a certain moment, so they told him. So he came to the village, and just a few seconds or a minute before the decisive point, he took the girl, put her on his horse, and rode off. Well, naturally, the elders followed them, and having fresh horses, and being many, they came nearer and nearer and nearer. And the girl said to the man, "This does not make any sense, what we are doing. The further we go, the nearer they will come. Let's do something else." And he said, "What can we do?" And she said, "Let's get down from our horses and pray to the gods." And he did something which was, again, much more clever than most men, what most men would do. He said, "All right." So they went, they got off their horses and prayed to the gods. And at this moment there was a big storm, everything was black, they couldn't see anything. And when the blackness lifted and they could see, there was the Grand Canyon between their pursuers and themselves. This is how the Grand Canyon was created. Well, now, this is a very poetic story with regard to the men's attempts to break through the limits of tribalism. But I'm mentioning it here mainly for one reason, that here you have the principle of the third possibility, namely that if one recognizes that a certain course cannot lead anywhere except to destruction, it just doesn't make any sense to pursue it. And that the attempt to see another possibility, even if this possibility seems remote and is remote, it is still more realistic than to be caught in a cliché alternative and pursuing something which certainly will not lead anywhere. In this case, the third possibility was that of praying to the gods. Well, it seems very strange indeed that in a culture in which one talks so much about God, very few people think of the possibility that it might even be more realistic of praying to God than
of continuing with the arms race. George Kennan said in one of his lectures precisely this, and he's a sincerely religious man, "I do not precisely pray to God, although I don't find myself so different from the times when I did, but I'm mentioning this because praying to God in some way is a symbol. It's a symbol for believing in the human possibility which transcends the realm of calculation. What people are caught in general is the belief that if they are confronted with a lesser and a bigger evil, they ought to choose the lesser evil. The facts as we have witnessed them since 1914 are that whenever we choose a lesser evil as against the bigger evil, the only result is that it takes somewhat more longer time until the bigger evil occurs, but it occurs with all the more certainty." What this story here presents, and what is one of the most important points, I believe, for anyone who takes our spiritual religious tradition and humanistic tradition seriously, is precisely the attempt to see that the choice between two evils does not lead anywhere, and that logically it doesn't make any sense to pursue something which obviously does only lead to destruction because one doesn't see any other possibility. In Goethe's drama Iphigenia, Goethe has posed the same problem. I don't have the time to explain it. The point is that Iphigenia, being confronted with the bigger evil of being killed and having to kill her brother and his friend, or to deceive her king who had been kind to her and had confidence in her, in contrast to the Greek drama of Euripides, where she chooses the lesser evil of deceiving the king, at one point feels she cannot do it. And she chooses a new alternative, that of the truth. And she tells the king the truth, not because she calculates this probably will be successful, but because the other two possibilities are no possibilities from a human standpoint. And when she tells the king the truth, the king says, "And dost thou think that the uncultured Scythian will attend the voice of truth and of humanity which Aetius the Greek heard not?" And she answers, "This voice is heard by every one born beneath whatever clime, within whose bosom flows the stream of life, pure and unhindered." This is precisely the same answer as in the Indian legend about the Grand Canyon. The voice of humanity is still the one chance we can trust, provided we see that the inhuman voices lead to certain destruction. And it is indeed a very important thing to see the contradiction between our claim that we believe in God, that the Russians are godless, that we believe in this, that, and the other spiritual ideal, when in our whole political thinking there is not even a thought from the standpoint of what it means that a person who believes in God is a Christian or believes in humanism, will take a different stand to the solution of problem than the one that we either, that we will risk the destruction to destroy our enemies or our enemies us. All this has to do, and I just want to mention that, with the fact that the humanist tradition of the Western world broke down around the beginning of the 19th century. And while the 18th century was in many ways a continuation of the 13th century humanism, the continuation of the faith in man and, if you please, in God, which is present in the Old Testament and the New Testament prophetic writings and in the best thinkers of the late Middle Ages, the 19th century has created a new idolatry, the worship of the nation state. And the idolatry is that right and wrong is not anymore determined by what is right or wrong from a spiritual, religious, humanistic standpoint, But right is what serves the Moloch. And the Moloch is here the nation state, and wrong is what may not serve him. And in fact, the irrationality of it is that many mistakes are even made rationally of what could serve the Moloch. Well, I'm sure my time is over by now, so I shall conclude just with this one sentence. I believe war can be avoided if we if we take a new approach on two levels. One, in our knowledge and more correct interpretation of facts, and another one which is equally important, the two cannot even be separated from each other, namely, in being at least sincere with our own ideals, with our own values, in having the courage to either take them seriously or not using God's name in vain, and not only God's name, but the name of all that humanity has created in these last 4,000 years. And I believe that the future of this country, provided we have a future, rests on a renaissance of these values on which our culture is built, and not on the arms which will, if the arms race goes on, destroy everything which we cherish. Thank you.